2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium. Session 173, How Powerful is God? Process in LDS Theology and Dialogue. Panel, James McLaughlin, Dan Weatherspoon, Blake T. Osler, Mary Winder Stromberg.
A full room of people who are willing to listen to something as arcane as people talk about Whitehead. I did not expect this. I gave a talk on William H. Chamberlain once here at Sunstone. And a guy came in cleaning up the room, was asking if we were still using it. Let me introduce the august members of this panel. This is Dan Weatherspoon, who is currently the editor of Sunstone. He did a PhD in religion at Claremont School of Theology, Claremont Graduate School. There he studied with, that's kind of process central. He studied with David Griffin and John Cobb and Marjorie Suhaki. And so he's a person who's well-grounded in process philosophy. Over here we have Blake Osler, who you should all remember. At least I think you should know him. Blake is a recovering process person, I think, although he says he's still sympathetic with it. And just a second. Here, just hold on. He's written this book, which I read parts of years ago, and he's been working on it for a long time. It's a great book. It's called Exploring Mormon Thought, The Attributes of God. And what makes Blake is going to come out with Coulford Books, the end of the month. So, go out and buy one. Can you order advance copies?
Yeah, there will be sheets to get advance of copies tomorrow here, I believe. Greg, in the trade here?
Yeah, they'll be pre-ordering and then we'll have the Sunday tomorrow. The outfits.
$39.95?
Yeah, what is the cost?
That's what I heard.
Okay,
well, here it is.
Oh,
yeah. Tomorrow he's going to talk about this book, and so are you, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That's Potter back there. sorry, I'm not good at this, am I? Okay, well, one of the amazing things about Blake, too, is he's a lawyer who does this in his spare time. Years ago, I once asked him, how do you write this stuff? He said, well, every night I work from 10 to 2. And then he says he gets up at 6 and goes and does his lawyering stuff, which was amazing to me. The most important member of our panel here, because she's never read anything about process theology until when?
About 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. So her mind was not corrupted yet. Is Lori Winder Stromberg, who did her MA in Humanities at BYU, and is the former editor of the Mormon Women's Forum Quarterly, and I'd say more about her, but I just met her, now. We talked on the phone yesterday. My name's Jim McLaughlin. I'm from Cowley, North Carolina. I teach at Western Carolina University out there, which is, we are the only four-year state university with no town. I'm in the philosophy and religion department there, and I spent last year in at Claremont. I followed my wife out there. She was doing a PhD and worked on process theology. And then Dan and I decided we'd put this panel together, expecting only one or two people to show up. But anyway, we're going to have Dan go first, and he's going to do a short explanation of process theology. Lori's going to respond from the point of view of common sense. then I'll say something, and then we'll give the last word to Blake, and then everybody can talk after that.
Thanks. I have to begin with a little bit of just my own personal journey with process theology. I made it through BYU without really giving any other system of thought a whole lot of, chance to move me. I completed a degree in philosophy, and I read the philosophers, and I enjoyed them, and I certainly passed all, my exams and wrote good papers, but I never really once had considered you know, that Joseph Smith didn't really have it all figured out, and these guys were, you know, good, but didn't have, you know, certainly partial in their ability. And so in many ways, process theology represented for me a Rubicon, some sort of passing over to where I finally learned to quiet the Mormon lens, especially the Mormon one and only true lens. And I dove into a system that I just found to be beautiful and exciting and fertile. And, you know, early on I was still writing, parallel with Light of Christ and Mormonism, there are these things in margins. Pretty soon I was writing, this would be pretty good if Mormons could do this with their theology. You know, I should be saying we Mormons could do this with ours, but in your notes you're writing LDS instead of us, you know, and things like that. And so process theology is just, for me, is I'll love it forever. and because of these things that it taught me, and just how many wonderful teachers I met, how many wonderful thinkers. My favorite feminist authors are influenced by process thought. My favorite animal rights people, Jay McDaniel, is just a guy that I love, again, a process theologian. And so, you know, you're not going to find a whole lot of critique from me. So it's a good thing that I'm the one that's kind of assigned to, at least for those of you who don't know a little, just a few of the nuts and bolts of what's going on here. That's my role, and it's good because I'm more interested in getting you excited about process theology as something you want to explore and have that same sort of experience that I did of causing you to grow and stretch than I am about critiquing it. So you're going to get the little preacher up here for that. Before we look at how strange it is, let me tell you what I really admire about Alfred North Whitehead. One of my favorite quotes, I've used it, it'll be in, I'm doing my creed tomorrow, it comes up in that, but it's basically says there's a difference between ancients and moderns. And he finds this switch the kind of in the middle of the century with the Enlightenment. He says, prior to the Enlightenment, people used to ask themselves, what do I experience? Then with the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, the idea that we can figure out what truth is, it can be transcribed, etc., says they began to switch to what can we experience. So the switch from what do we experience to what can we experience was what he saw as a dividing line. And so what I love about Alfred North Whitehead is just this attitude that he looked at the world and he said, what are we experiencing? What must the world be like in order to have certain phenomenon? And the two that he focused on, he was writing from, you know, 1880s into the 1920s. Can you imagine? It's Einstein and relativity. And he's a mathematical genius. He's written an alternate to Einstein's theory of relativity that he feels handles multiple universes and things better than Einstein was able to. And then the second one is quantum theory. And most of you have heard that term, but basically it's the idea that it seems to be the case that there are energy states that go from one level to another without passing in between. So it's like, for instance, a person can walk 3 miles an hour, and they can walk 4 miles an hour, but they can't walk 3.5 miles an hour. It's sort of the example there. You can only go certain things. So as an atom or whatever excites and de-excites, it looks like it's jumping from one orbital shell to the next orbital shell without passing in between. And so with that, with William James in the air, with the idea that it's drops of experience, that the periodic way and a quantical way of viewing things was in the air. And so Whitehead, with this robust view of what do we experience, came out and said, what must this universe be like? And so that's why when we're going to now start drawing a few pictures here for you, this is what led him to this. You can decide whether it worked or not, but I wanted you to know what was behind it. What must the world be like given those two phenomena, and especially you'll see the influence on the question of quantum here. So for those of you who don't know, does everybody know what his big term is? What is the universe made of? What are really the only existing things in the universe? Have you heard of it? It's actual occasions of experience. Okay, so if any of us start talking actual occasions, you do it. So what we are, what everything in the universe is simply a series of one occasion after another, after another, after another. And so Blake, this is Blake. Basically, he's Blake for this moment, Blake for that moment, Blake for that moment, Blake for that moment, etc. And the reason, you know, here's Blake thinking that he's an unbroken chain. He's a temporal series of moments. And all of us are. God is. Well, with Whitehead, it's a little bit different, but Hartshorne, you heard Charles Hartshorne's name too. I kind of think of him as Whitehead as Plato. Hartshorne is Aristotle. Some of the problems that Plato had that Aristotle helped with, same thing with there. And so I think the dominant model, at least going on today, is even God is a series of actual occasions following each other like this. So what we are is this temporal chain, and the way that we influence each other, really that's the only question I'm going to try to get you enough information on, is how powerful is God? Well, how powerful is anything, is the question. How does anybody or anything influence each other in the process model? And so when we're a temporal stream of this, how does it work? Well, let me kind of give you a sense. We're going to try to isolate one of these moments in time first. And I need to quickly teach you a word called prehension. Okay? You heard of prehensile tail? A monkey, you know, it's kind of a grasping tail or something like this. So what happens is each individual moment, and it's just moment, 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 you've all had thousands of moments since you've walked and sat down in here today. Each moment begins with an openness to the entire universe. In other words, anything that's already happened in the universe, and Whitehead plays with the speed of light and all this stuff, so anything in the past universe, you are open to, you are experiencing. But as your subjective moment, this particular you at this moment, like I said, is Blake, 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 this is you, you select from this entire universe that you're open to what it is that you're going to actually sort of make your next moment. And so you prehend, or you have either a positive or a negative prehension of certain things in the universe. And of course, one of those things will be God and what God is hoping for you, etc. So we'll get to that in a second. So as you know, finish your moment in the sun and close off, you've effectively blocked out a lot of things, though you began, or each moment begins completely open to it. And so the whole goal is you become this, what you positively prehend. Now the reason Blake doesn't feel like a series of moments, and I'm raising you because I'm directing my attention here, and he's right there, nothing personal there. The reason none of us feel like this series of moments is what is going to be naturally the most influential moment on what you decide to be the next moment, the immediate past moment. So for instance, here we are cruising along, and you're not feeling this difference, but let me give you an example. Here you are listening to me finish this sentence, okay, right? And so obviously at least part of you who are listening to me, you know, finish this sentence was basically saying, I'm interested enough in what Dan is saying, but I'm going to let the next syllable or the next moment sort of have this sentence and the coherence instead of giving it enough attention. But think about it. As I'm saying, you are listening to me think about, you know, finish the sentence, how many of you all of a sudden said, I hear a hum in the room? You know, I'm starting to think about my girlfriend somehow. In other words, you're deciding, you know, even though it's, you know, the dominant thing is you're listening to me. Thank you. Appreciate it. But yet, all around us at each moment, other information is getting in and it's making itself present as we finish our little thing. And so that's how we feel the continuity with the past, but if you really think about it, all of a sudden you'll lose interest, right? And pretty soon, this temporal stream of events will change what it's listening to, what it's finding important in that moment. So you sort of follow me along with that? That's kind of the lesson of this, and now we'll start talking about God. So we'll change this one from Blake to God, just so I don't have to take paper. So here's God cruising along, and here's us.
I'm honored.
Okay. And we're one moment after one moment, one after one moment. Process theology is claimed. Jim, I think, will talk a little bit more about creativity at the bottom of the universe, maybe, you know, Blake or something. But God is very much interested in each of us because God is trying to maximize God's reach. God is positively preeming all of us, our entire beings, at each moment. And God is interested that we have sort of the God-like experience of embracing as much relations to positively preempting as much as we can as well. So what God is doing is offering in each moment a lure or an initial aim is Whitehead's main language for this. You know, do this. This will enrich your experience. This will lead you to greater depth, greater relationality, greater joy and excitement and experience. And so God is offering an initial aim. Here's, I have to draw again because I want to give you the sense that here you are and you're deciding what you're going to be in that moment. Anything that's happened in the past, you'll have that initial aim from God as one of the things that you can prehend or not prehend positively. And so God's only way of influencing you or anybody else in the world is what? Whether or not you decide to what degree to be attentive to God's initial aim or God's excitement for you to have greater experience. And so God is only influential through persuasion, through lure. This is what I would love, never through force. So one of the real attractive things to me is there is absolutely a sense of agency, and you decide at every single moment what you're going to be. God is always hoping the best for you, hoping the maximal, hoping the best relations, etc., but you decide each moment. One last thing, and then I'm done. So am I about 10, 12 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm almost done. Last thing. Relations. I've mentioned a couple times, process is also often called process relational thought. Whitehead called it a philosophy of organism. The idea that the whole universe is one giant relation to each other, etc. If you think about what this means, though, and this is actually the thing I developed in my dissertation, because I really wanted Mormonism to be able to get this same sort of thing into its theology. All of us are related to each other internally, not externally. Probably the simplest one is billiard balls. We can all affect each other the way billiard balls would be, but what's that basically? That's an external relation. I'm bumping into you, you're bumping into me, and kind of causing, you know, a mechanical sort of thing. Internal relationality means you, God, we all influence each other and actually constitute each other, because not only am I playing with, you know, we're playing with the entire universe of these series of occasions, and do I want to be constituted by you? Do I want to be positively prehended? Do I want to bear your burdens? Do I want to mourn with you? Do I want to be this? How much relationality do I want? Is basically what God is luring us into, more and more relation. And it's a nice relation. It's an internal relation into which I am saying I'm willing to take all of you. I'll take your crap. I'll take your joy. And it's this idea of being fully constituted. So I kind of played with the light of Christ and a few things in my dissertation to sort of at least push us in that direction. So internal relationality is something that I'm excited that he at least has a metaphysic that sort of does it versus others. So hopefully that gives you at least a little bit of a sense. Some of the vocabulary that will probably come up. And thanks for your rapt attention as we finished each sentence. You hung in there pretty good, so thanks.
I wish I'd heard that before I started this. Given the fact that I'm not trained in philosophy, you may wonder, as I did, why Dan asked me to participate on this panel, with the rather surprising caveat, I might add, that I did not have to wade through Whitehead in order to do so. Other than out of the normal desperation that usually goes along with symposium planning, I think part of the reason I'm here is that I'm one of the few non-philosophy geeks that actually shows any interest in sessions such as this with any regularity. To Dan and the other panelists I've spoken with since, thought the perspective of a layperson might help to ground the discussion or perhaps make it more meaningful in everyday religious terms, although I think you've done a very good job, Dan. And since I'm writing as a layperson, my presentation is necessarily, completely, and unapologetically derivative. So let's jump in. The focus of my comments will be on the overarching emphasis in both process theology and Mormonism, as I understand them, on becoming rather than on being, and the compelling implications of a finitistic versus an absolutistic view of God. Sterling McMurrin has suggested that the problem of being and becoming has been one of the most persistent and difficult issues in Western thought, and the decision to go in the direction of being, with its commitment to perpetual identity and timelessness, or in the direction of becoming and temporality, with its risk of ontological instability and irrationality, was and still is a fundamental problem in metaphysics, and one with which process theology and Mormonism fundamentally grapple. I want to begin with some possible parallels between process theology and Mormonism identified by Floyd Ross in his article Process Theology and Mormon Thought, which was published in Sunstone several years ago. In so doing, however, I want you to recognize that I don't believe these parallels to be perfect. In McMurrin's words, the two have some interesting common ground, and at some points there may be actual identities. When looked at broadly, then, Mormonism and process theology appear to share the following ideas. One, both shy away from absolutisms, and both accept pluralistic entities within an overarching oneness. Two, both recognize that rationalism, empiricism, and intuition all have their place in a worldview that is empirically grounded. Three, each accepts the idea of God's finiteness or limitedness, and each recognizes that everything is related to everything else, including God. In place of the old view that universe, and especially the human beings in it, are subservient to God, slaves, abject creatures, there is a recognition of co-creativity. In every event or occasion, there is the possibility of new departures, new insights, new intuitions, revelations in theological language. Five, there is a positive estimate of matter, the human body, of all actual entities. Neither matter nor human nature is downgraded. And six, the whole universe is becoming, in process, in change, including God. While God's aims are universally active, their realization is not guaranteed. Thus, for God as well as for man, the future holds both men and women. The future holds both opportunity and risk. I'm reminded here of John Caputo's discussion of deconstruction at a former symposium. Did any of you hear that? Anyway, he talked about being hospitable to risk. I remember thinking Mormon theology embraces risk in a truly radical and ultimate sense. I'll say more on that later, but right now I want to insert a thought or two about language. McMurrin asserts that Mormon theology is in principle basically non-absolutistic, and that even Mormon ethics is in certain respects non-absolutistic. I'm sorry, let me start again. That Mormon theology is in principle basically non-absolutistic, and that even Mormon ethics is in certain respects non-absolutistic does not mean at all that the generality of Mormons do not have strong absolutistic tastes. On the whole, they are infected with the absolutisms that are common to all types of conservatives, and they are very much the victims of the traditional language and diction that have been produced by Orthodox religions. So, for example, Mormons often describe God in the language of traditional Christianity as omniscient and omnipotent, when we mean radically different things. Or do we, is the question here, and maybe the panelists can address that. Has the use of such terms, and in recent years our desire to appeal to mainstream Christians, blinded us to the fact that we are finitists? We are at the very least schizophrenic in our discourse. In Mormon doctrine, McConkie, using language from the Lectures on Faith, i.e. the early Joseph Smith, asserts, by definition, God, generally meaning the Father, is the one supreme and absolute being, the ultimate source of the universe, the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good creator, ruler and preserver of all things. God is omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient. finite and eternal, infinite, sorry, and eternal, from everlasting to everlasting, the same unchangeable God, the framer of heaven and earth, and all things which are in them. Just a few pages later, however, he quotes from the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, specifically the King Follett Discourse, in other words, the later Joseph Smith. God himself was once as we are now, and is an exalted man, and sits enthroned in yonder heavens. I'm going to tell you how God came to be God. We have imagined and supposed that God was God from all eternity. I will refute that idea and take away the veil so that you may see. It is the first principle of the gospel to know for a certainty the character of God, and to know that we may converse with him as one man converses with another, and that he was once a man like us, yea, that God himself, the Father of us all, dwelt on an earth the same as Jesus Christ himself did. Here, then, is eternal life, to know the only wise and true God, and you have got to learn how to be gods yourselves, the same as all gods have done before you, namely, by going from one small degree to another, and from a small capacity to a great one, from grace to grace, from exaltation to exaltation, until you inherit the same power, the same glory, and the same exaltation, until you arrive at the station of a God and ascend the throne of eternal power, the same as those who have gone before you. There are ways in which Whitehead and process theologians have, too, wrestled with reconciling becoming with the impulse to cling to the assurance of the absolute. Thus, for many of them, God is dipolar, or has two natures. I'm quoting extensively here, by the way. God has a primordial or transcendent nature, his timeless perfection of character, and he has a consequent or immanent nature by which he is part of the cosmic process itself. And although God in his primordial nature transcends the world, he as actual entity includes the world consequently within himself and suffers and grows along with it through the creativity which he and the world possess. For Whitehead, there must be some actual entity which grasps and valuates all the eternal objects and can act as the universal agent and transcendent source of order and value in the world. Without God, the cosmic process would not be an orderly, creative process, but only a chaos. God, by his primordial nature, acts as the principle of limitation, or concretion?
Concretion.
Concretion.
The act of closing is the act of concretizing.
Okay. Enabling the world to become concretely determinate by aiming at certain values within divine limits of freedom. For Charles Hartshorne, God has an abstract nature and a consequent nature. The attributes of God's abstract nature are those, I'm quoting from him, are those divine qualities that are eternally necessarily true of God regardless of the circumstances, whereas the qualities of God's concrete nature are those particulars of God's being which he has gained by his interaction with the world in accordance with the circumstances. God, then, is necessary according to his abstract nature, but contingent according to his concrete nature. He is independent in his abstract nature, but dependent in his concrete nature. He is supremely absolute in his abstract nature, but supremely relative in his concrete nature. No one can surpass him in the supremacy of his social relatedness to every creature. Parenthetically, Blake has called him the most moved mover. But God can surpass himself. In other words, he can and does grow, not to become morally better or more perfect, but to grow in the joy and feeling of the world, in knowledge of actual events, and in the experience of the values created by the world. Thus, God is the self-surpassing surpasser of all. Now, later, I would like my fellow panelists who have thought about this much more than I have to address the question, can the Mormon God be described as dipolar? In other words, does the Mormon God have a distinct, transcendent, timeless nature and a consequent or immanent nature that allows participation in the cosmic process, as process theologians have suggested? So, what then is the Mormon doctrine of deity? My understanding of the LDS concept of God, briefly, is the following. In denying the traditional doctrine of creation ex nihilo, LDS theology supports a finitistic view of God. According to McMurns, the Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion, God fashioned, and I'm going to read extensively from McMurrin now, God fashioned the world from pre-existent, eternal, and indestructible elements that are given constituents of the universe, having in themselves the ground of their own being. The created world can come into being, and theoretically it can go out of being, for its existence is contingent upon God's creative act. But the elements which compose it, and, in typical Mormon thought, the space and time which they are in, cannot begin and cannot cease to exist, for they are eternal and have necessary being. And among these uncreated entities are the intelligences that are the essential being of persons, whether human or divine. Finitism, in the concept of God, follows necessarily from the denial of ultimate creation, a finitism that places Mormonism in fundamental opposition to the absolutism that has been a primary assumption of theological discourse throughout the history of Christian thought. While Mormon theologians have moved somewhat ambiguously between the emotionally satisfying absolutism of traditional theism and the radical finitism logically demanded by their denial of creation, in Mormonism, when seen, God is described in non-absolutistic terms as a being who is conditioned by and related to the world of which he is a part, and which, because it is not ultimately his creation, is not absolutely under his dominion. As a constructor or artisan god, not entirely unlike Plato's demiurge in the Timaeus, the Mormon deity informs the continuing process of reality and determines the world's configurations, but he is not the creator of the most ultimate constituents of the world, either the fundamental material entities or the space and time that locate them. God's environment is the physical universe, the minds and selves which exist but are not identified with him, the principles under which reality is structured, and perhaps even the value absolutes which govern the divine will. In any case, it is entirely evident that it is a basic article of Mormon theology that God is related to a world environment for the being of which he is not the ultimate ground, and by which he therefore is, in some sense, conditioned. This means that God is a being among beings, rather than a being as such, or the ground of being, and that he is therefore finite rather than absolute. The doctrine of God's temporality is the most radical facet of Mormon finitism, and certainly the most important, for by its very nature, temporality involves process. As the concept of time can have meaning only as a measure or context for events, God is placed, therefore, not above or without, but within the ongoing process of the universe. The ultimate immutability of reality is thereby denied, and world history, human effort, human achievement, I would add human struggle, and human freedom take on a new meaning, for the future is real and unique, not merely from the perspective of men and women, but as well from the perspective of God. Almost done. The moral decisions of men and women make a difference, and a very genuine difference, not only in their own destinies, but for the outcome of human history and of the world. God struggles endlessly to extend his dominion over the blind process of the material world, and to cultivate, and I'm adding by persuasion, the uses of freedom for the achievement of moral ends. I want to end with a few suggestions as to the religious strengths, weaknesses, and implications of process theology and the finite God of Mormonism. According to Dehiel, process theology gives clear and plausible form to a dynamic, personal view of God. Personal qualities such as self-consciousness, creativity, knowledge, and social relatedness are attributed to God in the most literal sense. However, he continues, and from a traditional Christian viewpoint, process theology has some problems concerning the finitude and temporality of God. In other words, the problem of relating God's infinite, non-temporal, primordial nature to God's finite, temporal, growing, and consequent nature. There is also the question of the religious adequacy of God. Is the most worthy object of worship a God who needs the world in order to be a complete being, personal being, or a God who is a complete personal being prior to the world? In addition to these philosophical problems, there are some characteristics of process theology which, from the viewpoint of evangelical theology, are contrary to Scripture. These include a non-tripersonal view of the Trinity, a non-supernaturalistic view of the Bible and Christ's works, the denial of divine foreknowledge and predestination, and my favorite, and a weak view of human depravity. So, from McMurrin and Mormons, there can be no question of the theoretic strength of a finitistic conception of God, for it salvages faith in the supreme goodness of God and in the meaningfulness and worth of the moral experience of men and women. I find the idea of a finite, progressing God spiritually and intellectually compelling. Having grown up Mormon, I am compelled by the idea of a God who wants peers, by a God who has overthrown traditional notions of power based on dominance and subservience, by exemplifying a model of power used to empower, by a God who does not want slaves and fawning underlings and does not require adoration or worship in the traditional sense, by a God who struggles with us, by a God who is expanded by our experience in reciprocity and relationship. I'm also compelled by the idea that our choices and actions have real consequences and risks. William James wrote, suppose that the world's author put the case to you before creation saying, I'm going to make a world not certain to be saved, a world the perfection of which shall be conditional merely, the condition being that each several agent does its own level best. I offer you the chance of taking part in such a world. Its safety, you see, is unwarranted. It is a real adventure with real danger, yet it may win through. It is a social scheme of cooperative work genuinely to be done. Will you join the procession? Will you trust yourself and trust the other agents enough to face the risk? To this I would answer a resounding yes. After all is said and done, however, McMurrin suggests that it appears that those who seek the consolations and inspiration of religion are as a rule not willing to worship anything less than ultimate and absolute power. Clearly, they are not willing to take their problems to a God who may have problems of his own. Is the Mormon God I have described, then, a God in whom we can have confidence? I leave that to you and my fellow panelists.
Amen. Let me start out. Well, I'm going to play fast and loose with Rob Whitehead because my education was in existentialism and German mysticism and idealism. I came to Whitehead a little bit later. But what attracts me to process theology are those elements that it shares with existentialism, not with quantum mechanics, of which I know nothing about. Okay, I'm going to start out telling my favorite Kant story. Let me get my watch so I don't go over time. I'm going to tell you my favorite Kant story and my favorite Whitehead story because I think they go together. This is an apocryphal story about Kant. The story was that when he was working on the Critique of Pure Reason, anybody have the misfortune of ever trying that one? He gave it to a fellow German university colleague, and if you've ever met German university professors, you know what they're like. Guy kept it for 6 weeks, returned it with a little note on the bottom saying, if I read any more, I fear I shall go mad. Whitehead, in a similar vein, was one of the great mathematicians in the world. And then at 65, he retired from mathematics at the University of London, went to Harvard, and decided to become one of the great philosophers of all time, at least in my opinion. He, in the early 20s, was given the opportunity to give the Gifford Lectures at St. Andrews University in Edinburgh. And what he did was he went in with his draft of Process and Reality. Many of you have ever tried to read that. And he started to read to a full lecture hall. And as the time went on, the crowd got smaller and smaller until there were, you know, by the end of the thing, which is about 400 pages long, there was almost no one there. And I assure you, had I been there, I wouldn't have stayed either. It is a darn difficult book to read. And so I'm going to read you some of it. Don't leave yet. This is the easy part, I think. Because there's a story to this, too, I guess. Years ago, I was on a panel here at Sunstone on the theological contributions of Sterling McMurrin. And I got up and said, there has to be some sense in which we think of God as being absolute. And Sterling McMurrin said, as well as finite. And Sterling McMurrin said, gee, I haven't heard anybody else say that but Joseph Fielding Smith, you know. I was sympathetic to that. But what got me interested in process theology was just that point. That there's really two ultimates playing around in the process view of God. And if I can be chalkboard dependent here. Well, let me read the quote first, and then you can wonder what the two ultimates might be. Bertrand Russell, Potter's back there in the back of the room, he does philosophy of mathematics. They wrote this book together, Principia Mathematica? Yeah. And years later, I mean, Russell was really disappointed with the way Whitehead went and said to Whitehead, this may be another apocryphal story, you've become muddled. And Whitehead turned to him and said, yes, but it's better to be muddled and significant than clear-headed and trivial. Okay. Oh, no, I was going to read the quote. In all philosophic theory, there is an ultimate, which is actual in virtue of its accidents. It is only then capable of characterization through its accidental embodiments, and apart from these accidents is devoid of actuality. All with me, right? In the philosophy of organism, which is another word for process philosophy, this ultimate is termed creativity. So we have two ultimates. One of them is God. It's creativity. Now, what's that? It's not being. It's not a substance. It's a characterization of what is. Creativity is without a character. It is of its own exactly in the same sense which Aristotelian prime matter is without a character of its own. It is the ultimate notion of the highest generality at the base of actuality. Whew, okay, all of that. Okay, so we've got creativity. Let's call it the impersonal ultimate. Okay? And then, let's have God. David Griffin, who's another process person, does this. And let's call that the personal ultimate. Now, process, because I do German idealism and mysticism and these things, process people didn't come up with this. This has been around for a long time. You read Meister Eckhart. Meister Eckhart has what he calls the Gottheit, the fertile ground, beyond which the distinction between humanity or the creatures and God disappears. And then you have what is, and you have God and the world, and it's personal. But I'm going to start out talking about what that might mean, reading from somebody who wasn't a process theologian but was Whitehead's colleague at Harvard. They used to teach courses in metaphysics together. His name is William Ernst Hocking, and he actually has a slim Mormon connection. William H. Chamberlain, who's my hero, he was the first Mormon to actually do formal studies of philosophy. Studied with George Holmes Hallison at Berkeley, and Hocking was there, and then he went to Harvard and studied with Josiah Royce, and Hocking had moved to Harvard by that time, so they sort of knew each other. This is about something called internal relations. This is one thing Dan was talking about. The difference between external and internal relation. Here we have an example of an external relation. Pen's here, this is here. Two objects in the world. Internal relationship, I want to do this in existentialist terms. You are deeply affected by someone you love. They are in you. You are what you are in relation to them. And this is the way Hawking describes it in relation to his wife. Well, anyway, it's in here somewhere. Okay, I have sometimes sat looking at a comrade, speculating on this mysterious isolation of self from self, the external relation. Why are we so made that I gaze and see of thee only the wall and never thee? This wall of thee is but a movable part of the wall of my world, and I also am a wall to thee. We look out at one another from behind masks. How would it seem if my mind could once be within thee, and we could meet and without barrier be with each other? Then it has fallen upon me like a shock. But I am thy soul. These things around me are in thy experience. They are thy own, and when I touch them and move them, I change thee. And when I look upon them, I see what thou seest. When I listen, I hear what thou hearest. I am in the great room of thy soul, and I experience thy very experience. For where art thou? Not here, behind those eyes, within that head, in darkness, fraternizing with the chemical processes. Of these, in my own case, I know nothing. In my existence, for my existence is not spent not behind my wall, but in front of it. I am thee, where I have treasures, and there art thou also. This world in which I live is a world of thy soul and being, within what I am within thee. I can imagine no contact more real or thrilling than this, than that we should meet and share identity, not through ineffable inner depth alone, but through the foregrounds of common experience. Okay, now, what Hawking is saying here, and this goes back to Hegel, and Jakob Berma, and all sorts of people like that, is near to what Whitehead is saying when he's talking about the concrescing entity and putting it in all those terms, that we are internally affected. We are what we are in relation to everything else, and especially to those beings that are closest to us. They are in us. You know, think about what the Freudians talk to you about when they talk to you about your parents. Okay, they're in there. And you can deny them or you can accept them. This, for me, is similar to what good old Mormon guy B.H. Roberts says when he's talking about in Mormon Doctrine of Deity. No, this is from the Comprehensive History of the Church, sorry. To this supreme intelligence, are other intelligences necessary? He without them cannot be perfect, nor they without him. There is a community of interest between them, also of love and brotherhood, and hence community of effort for mutual good, for progress, for attainment of the highest possible. Therefore, are these eternal divine intelligences drawn together in oneness of mind and purpose, in moral and spiritual unity? So how do we get an absolute out of this? We talked about, persons in relation. Well, we get the absolute by going back to this notion of creativity as the impersonal absolute. Nikolai Berdyaev, who's another one of my favorites, an existentialist and considered by process people a kind of proto-process philosopher, calls this the ungrund. If you want to go back and talk about Joseph Smith and the King Follett discourse, you could call it chaos. Pure potentiality. Not anything that is. You could go to Upanishads and talk about the neti neti, or the field of being for Buddhists. Not anything that is, but a potential to be. Slavoj Žižek, I think the best way to put this is to use, it, this doesn't quite work, but I want to use it anyway, because it's a good way to explain it. Slavoj Žižek is a contemporary Croatian philosopher who likes to talk about popular culture. And he writes a book called The Invisible Remainder. And what he talks about in there is, in a book by a German philosopher named Schelling called Of Human Freedom, how God comes to be. Okay, God comes to be in relation to, and God can only be, and this is the internal relation again, in relation to another. Hegel makes this point. You can only have mothers if you have daughters. You only have God if you have, as Jakob Berman said, children. or creatures or whatever you want. So there is a dependency there. You only get this personal being with that dependency. And the way Zizek describes this is in terms of Harold Ramis' film Groundhog's Day. Okay, the chaos of insanity, of never going anywhere. Bill Murray is trapped in, what's that place, Pitsmomany, Pennsylvania? Anybody? Yeah, that place. Okay. He's trapped there in this kind of rotary motion of desire. Okay, creativity, but not going anywhere, not doing anything. He has this infinite number of possibilities, but none of them go anywhere. He robs the bank, wakes up the next morning, he's still there. Okay, this doesn't quite work, but you get the idea. Unless you take a direction, unless you move in some direction, nothing happens. He gets out of the rotary motion of possibility when he starts to love the people in the town, and especially when he falls in love with the woman. Really falls in love with her. Not with himself, but with her. And is affected by them and what they do. And in a process view of the world, this is how God comes to be. God comes to be personalized in time. For me, this is a very much a Mormon view of things. If you read Joseph Smith, you read King Follett Discourse, you know, why are you not like God? Because you haven't quite brought the whole universe into you yet in such a way. You read 88 section of the Doctrine and Covenants, where it talks about Christ coming, you know, above and below all things. Going below all things was important too, not just being above it. The theological traditions have this thing about above. Okay? But below is important, more important perhaps. And you know, this is our job as well. So if you want to have your cake and eat it too, if you want God to be absolute, God is absolute because he's identified with this, with what is, with the possibilities of being, with love, which is the great Christian virtue. And that's why God becomes God, and at that moment God becomes absolute. As John Cobb describes Christ in his book, Christ in a Pluralistic Age, Christ becomes God because he identifies with God's initial aim, which is the flourishing, I can never say that word, of all these other creatures. Now that's what I find attractive about process theology. I had a lot more quotes I was going to read you, but I'm going to give it up because I'm out of time. And I'm going to leave the time now to my friend Blake Osler.
Well, I love that. I love to hear people talk about love. One of the things I love most about Mormonism that I think is totally consonant with process view of things, and it's the thing that I value most about Mormonism, is that I think what Joseph Smith said, and this goes back to what Lori said, is that the very purpose of life consists in the fact that we've been invited into a relationship. And the nature of this relationship is such that it's the same kind of relationship that the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost have with one another. And the best way that that kind of relationship is taught is to give up all economic barriers and enter into a Zion where people won't stand for there to be poor among them, where they regard everybody that they see as a son or daughter of God, where there are no barriers. But it's also a persuasive type of lure that brings people into it. It's not coercive. And so people agree with one another. We call those covenants. I love that about Mormonism. What I love most about Mormonism is also what I love most about process theology. In process theology, I think it opens up new ways for us to talk about the reality of love and relating to one another that becomes meaningful. But I need to make something very clear. Being a Mormon, being a Christian, is far more basic to me than being a process theologian. I am a devout Christian who studies process theology, not a process theologian who studies Christianity. And that, I suppose, makes a very different type of view than I think for somebody for whom process theology is more basic. I want to begin, however, by reading to you some of the things I love. Now, for me, I love Whitehead. I happen to have I think I'm the only person that I know that has actually read Kant's Critique of Pure Reason all the way through in German. And I think I'm probably the only person here who's read the Summa Theologica all the way through in Latin. I love doing that kind of thing. And my guess is that I'm probably the only person here who's actually read Process and Theology all the way through in English. That's how much I love those kinds of things. But having read Process and Theology, it occurred to me that Charles Hartshorne was actually a more effective spokesman for Process Theology than Whitehead ever could have been. I want to begin with, we believe that God, and you know, we have these notions, but I think the most basic notion we have of God is that whatever else God is, He's perfect. And for, you know, forgive the he here, I'm using gender because it's something that goes along with God. But in His perfection, maybe God isn't even a he. The Godhead isn't a he. And I think that for Mormonism, the ultimate is an impersonal Godhead and not a personal Father, Son, or Holy Ghost. We have it built into our very theology. But the bottom line is, if we think about what perfection is, we stop and ask ourselves, well, is the kind of being that is described in process thought really perfect? Most of us, I think, and I believe that this is the real dividing line between scholastics and evangelical thought and Mormon thought. They think of perfection as an absolute upper limit, the greatest conceivable being. There's nothing beyond that. There's nothing that could possibly be more perfect. But when we speak of perfection as an absolute upper limit, we get something like immutability. It can't change. It's already the best. Therefore, it couldn't change. It'd have to change for the better, and it's already the best. Therefore, it can't change for the better. If it's perfect, it's not going to change for the worse, so it is just the way that it is. However, what I love about Hartshorne is that he can give breath to a kind of statement that puts into perspective what really is perfection. He says, God is absolutely perfect in knowledge, power, and ethical goodness. Does it follow that he is absolutely perfect in all respects? What about happiness or bliss? Surely religion is not, at any rate, so emphatic here. Is not God displeased by sin, and so something less than purely happy in beholding it? Does he not love us, and therefore sympathize with our sufferings, wish they were removed? Do we not wish to serve God and carry out his purposes, contribute to his life somehow? If all this must be explained as extremely misleading, if not indefensible, if God enjoys absolute bliss in eternity. So what he gives breath to here is the notion that not everything is an absolute upper limit in perfection. For instance, he would suggest that perfection might have the same quality as the greatest possible energy, integer, and that is there just ain't one. There is no limit. There's no limit to enjoyment. There's no limit to happiness. There's no limit really even to relationality. And so what he's suggesting is that the very assumption on which Thomas Aquinas' theology is built, the very kind of notion of God that evangelicals, for instance, would want to talk about, is not one that logically can work. I love this notion of relatedness. I want to talk a bit also about his proportional dependence. Now, you're also aware that God, and this is literally true for conventional Christianity, God has no internal relations. He only has external relations. And you've heard a lot about external, internal. I'll give you another example. There's a particular painting of Joseph Smith that I don't like. In fact, every time I see it, it really makes me quite upset. I'm internally related to the painting. It has an effect on me. But does my dislike of the painting have any effect on it? No. What Christians are suggesting is that God is more like the painting. It's not affected by anything. What Hartshorne and other process theologians are saying is, no, I think God's more like a sentient being than a rock. Moreover, what Christian theologians want to say is that God isn't affected by us in any way. To be perfect is to be absolutely unaffected because everything flows outward from God. He's the creator. He's the first cause and nothing could act on him in any way. This is how Hartshorne observes that kind of a notion. He says, the father that has as little as possible depends upon the will and welfare of his child is an inhuman monster. Let the child, say a daughter, be happy. Let her be miserable. Let her develop in a moral or a vicious direction. It is all one to an independent parent. We do not admire a man less because we know he would be a happier man if his son, who is wretched, became well and happy, or because we anticipate that when a child is born to him, it will enrich his life with many new joys. We admire not the amount, but the appropriateness of the joy. We rejoice in another's happiness. We grieve in his misfortune, but we do not praise or blame or admire on this account. Now, what process theologians, I think, have given a voice to is the view that God, well, to put it very lightly, we matter to God. Our lives add something to His. You see, on the view that evangelicals have in that tradition, We don't add one whit to God's perfection, to his happiness or enjoyment. It's all the same. If we should all go straight to hell, speaking of a state of mind, you know there's no microphone. Oh, there it is. Smallest thing I ever saw. Good. It wouldn't make any difference to God. It wouldn't affect him one whit. You see, he has no internal relations by definition. But I believe that the God that Christ talked about cares about us. We add to his being somehow. As unfathomable as that may seem to us, we make a difference. The God of Aquinas can give us virtually everything but the ability to make a difference to him, the ability to matter in life. At base, I think we all want to believe that somehow we matter, that even to God we make a difference. Indeed, one of the greatest strengths of Mormonism and of process thought is that in our pains, God is pained, and in our triumphs, God triumphs. That ultimately, those things that matter most are not at the mercy of those things which matter least, precisely because what matters to us matters, ultimately. I love that about process thought. Now, I want to tell you some problems. And when I say I have problems with process thought, it's like rooting for BYU at a football game. I'm true blue through and through, and I'm happy to admit it. When they get behind, or when I'm critiquing the quarterback and what a stupid three-step drop that was, I used to be a middle linebacker, so I do these things, okay? I know the formation they line up in, and the first thing out of my mouth is, why are they running that play? Because I know where they're going. I watched Lavelle Edwards so long, the minute they lined up, I knew where they were going. And I would begin my critique, but I love this team, you see? But it has faults. Well, I'm probably the same way a bit with process thought. I love it so much that I critique it. Because I'm a Christian, one of the defining moments in human history for me is when Christ came back from death. It's an amazing thing that happened. You see, in the New Testament, the apostles didn't expect that to happen. Even whenever Christ explains to them that he's going to be appearing in 3 days after he destroys the temple, or, you know, the kingdom is going to come in power, there's always a parenthetical that's added. In English, the best translation is they didn't have a clue what he was talking about. And they didn't have a clue what he was talking about. And when he showed up after the resurrection, that was stunning to him. One of the greatest problems I have with process thought is that I can't conceive how it can possibly happen within a process point of view. You see, those kinds of things are so completely out of the realm of what is possible by luring everybody to agree with you. They're explained on a completely different level. Moreover, let's suppose that an asteroid were headed for Earth, and it were on a collision course, and let's say it's about half the size of the moon, which would be completely large enough to obliterate the entire Earth. Would it make sense to get down on one's knees and say, look, I know this looks inevitable, Heavenly Father, but I believe we matter to you, and I'm just asking you if maybe possibly you'd divert that asteroid out of its course. I don't believe the process God can even be conceived to move the asteroid out of its course. Yet, no matter how many of us pray, what's going to happen because of the dominant past and the natural laws the way that they are, it's going to hit the Earth. But I believe that Christians would want to say that no matter what the situation is, God has power to overcome that. Indeed, I think that's kind of what the resurrection is all about. So I have a problem in that way. Now I'm going to get a little bit more technical, and you'll let me know when I'm running out of time. In the general theory of relativity, as opposed to the special theory of relativity, there is no simultaneity. What is now is conditioned upon an inertial perspective. Believe it or not, in relativity theories, you go faster, your ruler gets longer. It's an amazing thing, but measurements show that that's actually the case. Oh, as you go faster, go shorter. That's right. That's so you cross more time, you cross more space in less time. In any event, from another perspective. So what happens is we get a perspective on what is now only because we have a particular inertial perspective. Moreover, we're limited by light speed, so that, for instance, if something is outside of a certain range, it can't act on us. It's outside of the possibilities of acting on us. The problem is that God is supposed to have all inertial perspectives. There's supposed to be a single now in which God exists, but if there is no single now, it's pretty hard to conceive that he exists in a single now. It's also very, very difficult to make sense on this view how God knows what's happening throughout the universe, because there's no way to define what's happening throughout the universe. So there are big problems. There are even bigger problems. The universe, if we accept the very well-established, and some will take this as probably one of the finest theories in the history of science, Big Bang Theory and current cosmology. In Big Bang Theory, what we know is that about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, which supposedly happened about 16.5 billion years ago, there was radiation when matter coalesced into individual particles. Okay, in that event, what happened is radiation was given off. That's evidence of something that happened where we had extremely high temperatures. The background radiation, we can also see that there is a mutual recessional velocity of galaxies. What that means is that everything is moving away from everything else. It's expanding. And if you contract that back in time so that everything comes together, you come into a very, very, very small universe. So small that and this is amazing. You think, you know, we're taking things on faith. Walk outside, take a look at the mountains, then realize that not merely the mountains, but the entire sun, the entire solar system, the entire universe could fit into something far, far smaller than a spoon. It's really quite an amazing thought. But that's what scientists are actually saying. The problem is when you get it small enough, they reach what they call a singularity. At the singularity, all space, time, and matter cease to simply exist. That is, because space-time is merely a form of material reality, it also ceases to exist. That would mean also that the process God, who is emergent from, arises from the material universe, also ceases to exist. And so what that means is that we have no explanation whatsoever for how the universe got set up the way that it did, because God doesn't exist when it got set up. He can't be in the initial constants of the universe. Now, I may add that the critiques that I've just made regarding the Big Bang Theory could also be made against the Mormon view of God. If God has a material body and he's stuck within the universe of space-time, and space-time don't exist, then where is God at the time of the Big Bang? We've been discussing, there's an LDS fill list that many of us have a discussion on the internet. That discussion right now is centering on what the heck do we mean by spirit matter? Because spirit matter doesn't seem to have a whole heck of a lot in common with matter as we know it. That is, you see it only by pure eyes, which I take it means that a physicist, even with his most powerful instruments, couldn't get to it. That is, there's no way we can detect it, which means that it doesn't mean the same thing that physicists mean when they talk about matter. Well, what's left over of the word matter, then, when we say it doesn't mean what physicists mean? I would give you a very complicated answer based upon information theory, but I'm not going to do that. The bottom line with all of that is that what's interesting to me is that many of the problems that process theology faces, I face merely because I am also a Mormon. They're the same problems that need to be resolved. Now, if we had more time, I could actually give you my resolution to those problems within a Mormon cosmology. But I don't think that my resolution within a Mormon cosmology, because what I do is redefine spirit matter so that it's not regular matter. You see, spirit matter is not isomorphic. It doesn't have the same connotations as regular matter. Moreover, a glorified body doesn't either. It records in the Gospel of John, and if you take this kind of thing as historical, Christ appeared in a room, and it makes special note to state with the doors being closed. Why did it state that? Because it wanted to make a point. His physical body got in the room by entering through the walls. You see, it's not regular matter the way that we know it. Yet it could be the kind of matter that would hover off the earth when regular matter wouldn't. It might be the kind of matter. In fact, we want to say that the spirit world is where? Well, it's right here. Well, it's not. I don't see it. Well, it's right here. It's just in another dimension. So I want to say, well, it's, you know, matter that's in another dimension is kind of a mysterious matter to me. I'm not quite sure what it means. So, you know, the way I would resolve it within Mormonism is to say, well, spirit matter isn't continuous with matter as we speak of it. And we would need to redefine matter radically to make sense of it. But the process theology can't redefine what matter means, because what matter means in process theology is basically quantum events and the kind of matter that we know. Sure. In any event, I have the problem that God just doesn't have enough power in process thought. Moreover, the God in process thought, because he cannot control things, also can't have foreknowledge in any sense. God in the scriptures has foreknowledge, not because he knows what everybody's going to do with their free will, but because he is so powerful, he has a plan, and he can bring about his plan regardless of what you and I do. It says so constantly throughout the scriptures. But in process thought, God can't act coercively. He simply can't accomplish things if we won't work with him. I take it maybe there's something in the Bible about this, and maybe this is actually what God comes down to. You see, God made a creation, and it got so darned out of hand that he decided he would wipe out everybody, and the best he could come up with was a man who slept with his daughters. And that was good enough. And he decided he would start all over again and send a flood and wipe them all out. Well, it may be that God really can't control things, and things get so out of hand that the best he can do is start all over again. But at least the God of the Bible could start all over again. I'm not so sure the process God could.
Okay, we've got about 20 minutes. Why don't we throw it open to questions, speak real loud, and then we'll have the people respond. Yeah.
A question for Blake. You were talking about theory of relativity and the speed of light limits and so on. And this theory of relativity is either special or general. No information goes faster than light.
Right.
So you can't have a personal God for the whole universe. I mean, you can have... Because, you know, the information, you know, and messages, you know, just don't go that fast. They take billions
right.
of years. Maybe for the Earth or the solar system.
Even that would take long. It takes 9 minutes to get here from the sun. If I'm in a car, and the car's coming at me, and I say a prayer, that just takes too long to get to God.
Yeah.
So
what does this do to the whole, you know, process theology you're trying to get... ideas of one God for the universe?
Well, like I said, we would have to say that our notion of matter is equivocal. And by saying that our notion of matter is equivocal, we also want to say that God is an immanent being who's present throughout the universe. He's immanent in it because he also, if you will, is below all things because he exists in another dimension that has access to every space in the universe. God is here now. In fact, his spirit, you know, and here is a critical distinction that has to be made in Mormon discussions when we're talking about God, because the word is very equivocal. It's one of the things I deal with in my book. We can mean the individual divine persons. The individual divine persons are corporeal. They're made of glorified matter, or whatever that is. However, the Godhead is not. The Godhead is not a person. The Godhead is not made of matter. Moreover, the light of Christ, whatever that kind of light is through all things, in all things. Is something that is imminent throughout the universe, present here now. That's an impersonal aspect of God, but it's immediately present. So when we speak about God, it's important that we make distinctions about the way we're using the word. If God is imminent, if he's here now, I don't think there's any problem in God acting. Indeed, what I would say makes God imminent is that he can act here now immediately without any delay and without relying on any mediator for his act to be realized. Think about how you act on your arm. You form a thought, and if you're not paralyzed, your arm actually moves. Well, how did you do that? Well, your mind is immanent throughout your body. And so by the mere fact that God is immanent throughout reality, it seems to me that he might be able to act here now in all aspects.
My arm takes a fraction of a second to respond to my brain.
Grand. That's why we have to say that the material...
Squid, it takes even longer.
Right. Because it's a biochemical message, and it does take time for the message to travel. But that's also a point, when we're talking about theory of organism, that's why Whitehead talked about the universe, because he moves in the universe the same way we move in our body. And process theologians talk about the world as God's body by analogy. What I want to say, however, is that when we talk about God being present, we're not talking about information traveling. He simply is there. His influence is already there. And his mind is throughout the entire universe. There's not a part of it that he doesn't know, because he immediately experiences it. And no, it's for the same reason. I'll discuss it with you later. But let me say this: in inflationary theory, when the universe expands faster than the speed of light, there's no violation because that doesn't have to exchange information. Same response can be made here.
Well, I want to say that I'm impressed with the scholarship that's been given here in the study, and I can see the attraction and parallel between some of Mormon theology and so forth. But it seems to me that you can make arguments. I mean, it's an incomplete explanation that we would argue about. It's being done here today. Now, Einstein made the statement that the theory defines what can be seen. It seems to me one of the problems that exists here in the discussion is that we start out with the theory that man is finite. Consequently, the capacity that man brings as a finite being to understand the infinite is always inadequate. So, my suggestion is that we might consider that man is infinite and come from that, and then reality may be perceived from a different reference rather than from the finiteness of our definition there, that he is infinite. And if we'll let go of the static and garbage of a finite concept, maybe we'll hear the infinite.
Good. There's a wonderful book by Kierkegaard, Sickness Unto Death, in which he defines being a self as being both finite and infinite. And I think that's one of the things we get here in process theology is, yeah, I'm finite, I don't know everything, I'm here, my wife's out there. And yet, as Heidegger always loved to say, we always transcend that, we're always beyond ourselves. And there are infinite aspirations there, infinite desires. And with what Blake was talking about, with the notion of the Godhead and ways of looking at Section 88 of the Doctrine and Covenants, you've got to think that what God has done has fulfilled that in some way.
The point I'm trying to raise...
And we have that potentiality.
Yeah, the point I'm trying to raise here is that as long as we define ourselves, that's our point of reference. The thought leaves not its source. And if we start out as infinite or as finite beings in our understanding of ourselves, then we're just speculating about what can be.
Yeah, even there, we're jumping over the fence.
Eastern philosophy. Maybe this world is simply illusory, a dream, and there is a reality that could be reached by starting from the reference of infinite.
Would you have to say that the view that it's illusory is illusory?
Well,
the view that it's an illusion is illusion.
Oh. Yeah. If you could hide a kolob. The song. If you could hide a kolob. Remember the last couple of verses?
Yeah.
No one has gone beyond the thing and seen pure space. Because as soon as you jump over the fence, there's something there. This is the idea of creativity again. I mean, you don't see creativity. You don't. And then I think this goes along with what you're saying. As soon as we say we're just finite. Now, Hegel was great for this. Then you wonder what's on the other side of the fence. It's like when you're a kid, and they say, well, this is the end of the universe. Or this is the last number. We are infinite. Yeah.
Because I'm trying to sell tapes, please come up and use this for your questions.
Just a quick one. Isn't it possible that thought is faster than light? Maybe of a finer matter. So the big question is, what's the matter?
In fact, I argue in my book that it is a fallacy of reification. That means we take and make something concrete that ain't, to make a thought into a thing. Thoughts aren't, matter. They're something that emerges, I would say, from a process. However, the problem in relativity theory is precisely that it's information that can't travel faster than the speed of light, not merely matter. Information is the ultimate reality in the general theory of relativity. It's kind of an interesting notion.
Isn't thought information?
That's the problem. Thought itself is information. So given the postulates of general theory of relativity, especially theory of relativity, it couldn't travel faster than the speed of light. I will add, however, in my book I give several references. There have been what are called superluminal effects. There is, in fact, experimental evidence that tend to disconfirm the theory of relativity. There may be faster than light speed communication.
Actually, that's a good lead in my first question, and that was maybe we're putting a little bit too much confidence. Being a philosopher of science, I don't have a lot of confidence, actually, in scientific theories, or that they will stay the same for very long, because every scientific theory we've ever had has been overturned. I'm still a scientific realist in the sense that I think we get at real structures in our scientific theories, but just the fact that quantum mechanics and relativity seem so contradictory, the results in quantum mechanics just don't fit very well with the results, unless Brian Greene's right with superstring theory.
Right.
The results don't fit very well together, and so I'm not totally confident that we need to even worry. Well, it's good to worry about it, and it's great that Blake has given us a way that relativity, general relativity, would fit with Mormon theology, but in the end, we might not even need to do that. We might not need to speculate in that regard. So my first question is, should we really worry too much about the scientific results? But the other question, and this I think is better for the process panel here. I don't think I understand the difference between an internal and an external relation very well. I think that, from what I can tell, every relation is the way you guys have described external relations, including internal relations. The examples that you gave of internal relations were things like the love that you feel for your spouse or something like that. Well, that seems to me to be that's just a subclass of external relation. My spouse behaves in certain ways. I draw an analogy between her behavior and the kinds of behavior that I have when I feel a certain way, and then I suppose that she's feeling kind of the same way, and so I can kind of imagine the way she's feeling, and I relate to my imaginations of the way she must be feeling, and so forth, and that's my relation to her, and that seems to me to be an external relation ultimately, because you've got light waves coming to me and hitting me, and then I'm interpreting them in certain ways. I'm perceiving a certain thing, and it can be all broken down to an external relation, it seems, but maybe I'm wrong, and if so, I would like to know precisely what an internal relation is.
In order to make sense of this, you almost need to talk about Aquinas' concept of God and an absolute immutability. That is, if all relations are external, there can't be any even causal effects. It's not affected in any way. An internal relation would be something that would allow there to be effects between things, such that, take for instance, whatever it is that's essential to Dennis Potter. What is it that makes you you? Okay? I mean, you could shave your bald, you'd still be you, so you might not have hair. We could cut off your nose, you'd still be you, so you don't need a nose. But when we got down to whatever is essentially you, what we want to say is those properties can't change, but accidental properties can change. The fact that you have hair, that you have a nose, okay? In internal relations, those accidental properties can actually change. For Aquinas, there are no accidental properties. All of God's properties are essential to him. So he can't change at all and still be what he is. You could change and still be what you are. I think that might get best to the external-internal relation from an analytic point, which is where you're coming from.
Yeah, one thing, Buddhist conception of anatta, there is no soul. I think that actually fits better for Mormons. We are constantly changing. We are our history. We are our actions. Anybody, I think, who takes a kind of free will position as opposed to a kind of substantialist position, which Aquinas does, ends up there. Okay, and I guess a process theologian or philosopher would say, "You well, no, it's the other way around. External relations are merely a class of internal relation." Yeah.
Perhaps it's my simple mind, but I remember your first comment when you stood up break was talking about God is perfect. And it seems to me your standards that you set are standards that you pull out of the Bible and logically out of the Bible. But my question is, where do we get those standards to begin with? Why does God have to be perfect, other than by definition that we would have, for example? No, I'm perfectly happy to exist in a world with an imperfect God.
In fact, the entire first chapter of my book is based on that. I ask the question, what does God mean? And usually we take God to be a perfect reality. So I say, well, what if the most perfect reality were a very powerful, very knowledgeable person, very compassionate, but had some very significant defects? And ultimately what I come back to is something like what the lectures on faith say. The ultimate for purposes of religious faith is trust and faith. If you can't ultimately trust it, you're not going to ultimately rely upon it. And the only being that we could really rely upon and trust for our salvation is somebody that we could trust in all circumstances to be able to keep that his word or her word. The ultimate is somebody that could be ultimate love, and we know that they have our best interest in mind. Therefore, they have justice and mercy and love as their qualities. Those are the ultimate in Mormon thought. I'm ready to assert, based upon the lectures on faith, if they're Mormon, is love and trust. That's the ultimate. And we determine what perfection means in relation to those ideas, not in relation to metaphysical ideas. And I think this is a great dividing line between Mormonism and the rest of Christianity. In fact, I'd say this is the distinction between Mormonism and Christianity. for Mormons, God is essentially a relational being. He is essentially in relation to other beings and is looking out after their interests, and his interests are served by their interests. In standard Christian thought, in Islamic thought, in standard Judaistic thought, that just isn't the case. God is not a relational being ultimately. And so the universe begins in trust. In fact, in the lectures on faith, God creates because he has trust in himself. Yeah, it's in fact, God looks over the world. He says, there are a whole bunch of intelligences here who aren't as happy as I am. I'm going to make a plan so they can be.
Let me ask the question then. But why do we have to always talk in terms of ultimate? Why can't we talk in terms of extensive?
I would like to say that maybe in those terms there isn't an ultimate. It's like the greatest possible energy. There's no absolute upper limit. However, let me put it this way. Let's say that I said to my wife, honey, I love you, and I'm totally committed to you, but of course, if I ran into somebody who were prettier or smarter than you, I'd love her instead. So, if I said that, I think she'd have every right to look at me and say, well, you don't really love me at all. You're looking for something more ultimate than I am. Well, if we say, you know, I worship God, and I worship the God of this solar system, or of this world, and he's the most powerful being that I've ever met. But of course, if I met his father, if I met the God who was more powerful than this God, I'd worship that being instead. Why? Because when it comes down to it, if there's a disagreement among them, who's going to prevail? Now, I don't want to say that might makes right. What I do want to say, however, is that our notions of ultimacy make some sense. That is, we actually do make this hierarchy. What we want to say is that when it comes down to it, God is the ultimate trustworthy being. He's never going to let us down.
One thing, I think in Mormonism, ultimately, you know, section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants, verse 1 and 2, you know, where when it says, when we get there, we'll see him and we'll be like him. And then he says, the same sociality that exists among us here will exist among us there, except in a perfected form. The question of hierarchy is, you know, God's father is better than God, you know, bigger, better, more ultimate. This doesn't come up anymore. Yeah, because everybody, you know, everybody's ultimate. That's the point. That's what Lucifer didn't understand. He wanted to be, you know, the big guy. And what God's point is there is no big guy.
That's nice to say, but I really haven't taken up praying to Jim McLaughlin to heal anybody lately.
I talked to my ancestors.
Yeah. What I want to say is that when it comes right down to it, when we're in real life situations, when we've really got to trust somebody, it's God that we're going to turn to. There's a reason why there are no atheists in a foxhole. There are reasons why when a tornado is on the way, people don't rush down to the local 7-Eleven and read all about their favorite movie star. Because when life is really on the line, when things really matter, then those kinds of ideas begin to be nonsense. We are not, may I say this very lightly, we are not the kind of people that people will pray to. We are not ultimately trustworthy. Let me, however, add that when maybe we learn to keep our word, maybe when we learn to be ultimately trustworthy, then we will see as God sees and know as God knows.
Well, that's what I'm
yeah, and if that's what you're saying, then we're in complete agreement.
Okay.
I still ain't praying to you.
I won't pray to you. We have time for one more question. If anybody wants
Dan,
to
I'm curious
take
about
a
yours.
Shot. Let Dan talk. Yeah.
Go for it, Dan.
Take the last one.
Where do you stand on the absolute?
Well, yeah, I've been thinking, where can I jump in on this? I don't know. I just trade what Blake is trying to do for help with the problem of evil. Just over the last 5 years, I've really begun to realize that